Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, we go to the Midwest Political Science Association to talk with two political scientists about campaigns, elections, and how voters decide. Then we revisit the politics of power, who has it, and how it works, with the author of the classic, Who Rules America?
We're here at the Midwest Political Science Association conference that happens once a year in Chicago, so you can probably hear all the background noise. And I am sitting here with Sean Theriault, who is at the University of Texas and teaches political science there. There's so much going on right now in the American elections that I grabbed him and brought him aside so that we could talk a bit about what to make of this election. Seems historic, wouldn't you say, Sean Theriault?
I think it is historic. I think that for a long time we're going to be talking about the 2016 election, not in a way that we haven't been talking about 2000. There were some unique set of circumstances, the long run, and so we always go back to that as kind of a reference point, and I suspect 2016 is going to be one of those elections too, that there will always be things that we're referring back to 2016.
One of the things that I think may be historic, and we won't know just yet, is that both parties seem to have contested elections all the way up into their convention. Have we had that before?
Must have had it before. It's 1968. Certainly the Democratic was contested all the way up. I'm not sure when Richard Nixon wrapped it up. But for a long time, we didn't know what was going to happen at the conventions. It's only been in the last 20 years that we've developed this norm that a front runner wins early, solidifies the lead, and then waltzes to the nomination. The surprising thing in 2008 was how long the Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, we hadn't seen anything even close to that. And I suspect that the Republican is going to go to the convention. I'd be surprised if Bernie lasts as long as Hillary did in 2008.
What generally can people expect to happen at the conventions, especially with the Republican side?
I suspect that the Democratic convention is going to look a lot like the one in 2008. I think that Bernie is going to get a prime speaking spot. I think at that point he's going to be on board, and it's going to be a bit of a coronation, if you will, of Hillary. I think they'll be trying to generate lots of energy, because I think that that's one thing that her campaign has lacked a little bit so far. But the Republican convention, we don't know what's going to happen. When people speak about it and offer their commentary on it, they're always doing it in reference to the rules that were passed in 2012. But the Rules Committee for the 2016 convention hasn't even been named. They haven't met. So we have no idea what the rules that are going to be in place for the 2016 election. What we know from state law around the various states is that many of the delegates who are being elected right now in the primaries and caucuses are bound for their first ballot. Some are bound for a second and third ballots. And so we have a pretty good idea what's going to happen in the first ballot. We have no idea what's going to happen after that. At that point, the people who are at the convention, the delegates, become free agents. And so I think that there's going to be lots of bargaining and a lot of things happening. Now, I'll say behind the scenes, but not all behind the scenes, because there are going to be 24-hour news cycle, all sorts of new media. It's just going to be an explosion of information that is going to be hitting us trying to figure out exactly what's going to happen at the convention.
Now, you not only teach at the University of Texas, where one of the candidates is from, Ted Cruz, but you've also studied the Senate at length and the change when Newt Gingrich came over. And so with all of that background, give us some insight into Ted Cruz.
I think that what you're really learning right now is how much Republicans hate Donald Trump, because there's no way in a million years, a year ago even, that you would have ever been able to predict that you would have as much Republican support, establishment support for Ted Cruz. This man is reviled in the Senate. In my book, I talk about a class of senators that transform the way that the Senate operates as an institution. There's no class of Ted Cruz, right? There's Ted Cruz by himself, but just because of the rules of the Senate work the way that they do, he has a lot of power and control. And so you've seen some things that are quite embarrassing, actually, happen to him on the Senate floor when he asked for a second for a vote, and not a single senator will second a motion, so he can't get a vote on things. He has been known to force Congress to stay into session and then has not shown up the next day. And so he's done lots of things that have made his Republican colleagues absolutely furious at him, but yet those same Republican colleagues are now backing him. And I think that we can only interpret from that that it's a sign of how little regard and respect there is for Donald Trump.
Or is it more that he just is not really totally aligned with Republican values, Donald Trump?
Trump, right, that he's not aligned. And what I think what the Republicans fear is that if Donald Trump gets the nomination, then Donald Trump transforms what the Republican Party is all about. and even more so if he figures out a way to win the election. What they see with Ted Cruz is someone who personally they don't agree with. A lot of policies, though, they're not far away from where Ted Cruz is, but they see him as being within the realm of what Republican politics looks like. And so if he lost in 2016, the party isn't going to look that much different in 2020 as a consequence of a Ted Cruz nominee, but who knows what the Republican Party looks like after Donald Trump is done with it.
Then in terms of the overall election and what is happening with the primary, it's very anti-establishment in comparison, it seems, to the past elections. Do we attribute this to new media, or do we attribute it to the mood of the nation, or a little bit of both?
I attribute it mostly to, I would say, the mood of the nation. And the only way I would change the question the way that you asked it is that the energy is certainly behind the anti-establishment. But I'm not sure their numbers are bigger than they have been in the past. And there's not much energy among the establishment people in either party. A lot of people recognize that Hillary Clinton brings lots of talents to the campaign trail, perhaps even more talents to actually running a government if she were elected president. But they're not thrilled that she's the standard bearer. We saw what happened to anyone who had the label of Republican establishment in the Republican primary. And so I think that there's an unease among the American public, and that's where the energy is. And just because there's not another countervailing force of energy, it's dominated this election cycle.
I thought the anti-establishment, partly because Bernie Sanders has been on this radio program a few times in the past, I would have never, ever predicted that he could be a competition for somebody like Hillary Clinton. He was the socialist from Vermont. That seems just so unusual for American politics to me.
Right, so he is the socialist from Vermont, and I'm sure on the program you've heard this many times, his big issue is income inequality. And I think that's resonating with the American public in a way that it didn't as much 20 years ago. What we're seeing, and the data support this, is that the Obama administration has been wildly successful in terms of gains in the stock market and stuff like that. But as a consequence of that, the rich are getting richer, and the poor are still flatlining. And so there's a nerve now that Bernie Sanders is striking, and that nerve is bigger than it was 10 years ago. And certainly, if the trend isn't just with Barack Obama, this goes all the way back to the Reagan administration, when we've seen the rich just become richer and richer and richer. And so finally, the people who've been flatlined are the ones who are now more frustrated.
And what about the Donald Trump end of it?
I think Donald Trump can just speak to people concerns who don't know that much about politics. He's able to convince them that their frustrations are legitimate, even though a pretty basic understanding of the Constitution would suggest that type of campaign that Donald Trump is running and the type of president that he proclaims that he would be isn't at all consistent with what James Madison and Thomas Jefferson set up now more than 200 years ago.
So now as we're heading into the East Coast primarily, and then all the way back to California. It seems like, particularly on the Democrat side, the polls have been a little bit off. What do we make of that?
The polls have been a little bit off because part of the problem is that we're polling when people aren't otherwise paying attention. So we're thinking a little bit of Michigan and we're thinking Wisconsin, where the polls were off, especially 2 or 3 weeks out of the election. But when we look at the demographics of those states, we can't be that surprised that Bernie Sanders did better in them than the initial poll suggested. The results have been pretty consistent in that the less white the folks voting in the Democratic primary, the better that Hillary Clinton does, right? So she does much better among Hispanics and African Americans. And so now as we start heading to the East Coast and we start getting to New Jersey and New York, there are a whole lot more black and brown people in those states than there is in Wisconsin and Michigan. And so I would expect that Hillary will regain her footing in, even if she stumbles a little bit along the way, her delegate lead at this point is just so huge, not even considering the superdelegates. So Bernie Sanders wins this huge 13-point victory in Wisconsin and picks up 11 more delegates than Hillary. I mean, the rules are just written in such a way that the big jump that she got coming out of Super Tuesday is just really hard for him to make up at this point. The rules for the Republicans are not written that way. So Ted Cruz wins by the same 13-point margin, but walks away with 80% of the delegates out of Wisconsin. And so we'll have to pay particular attention of how those delegates are passed out in those states coming up. It's much easier for Donald Trump's campaign to have a quick stop than it ever would be for Hillary Clinton's.
Is there a cooling on Donald Trump?
We'll see. I mean, there certainly was in Wisconsin. There was a flurry of factors, though, that come into consideration. The two most popular Wisconsinites are the Speaker of the House and the Governor, and both of them were firmly behind Ted Cruz. Talk radio and conservative folks in Wisconsin were also behind Ted Cruz. And so we don't know if those same factors are going to be at play in quite the same extent. Ted Cruz, at one point, was quite critical of New York values. It's going to be hard to see him try and campaign in New York, having said that. Whoever would have imagined that New York would have been as important when he said it at the beginning of the campaign as it's turning out to be.
Well, thank you so much, Sean Thurill.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Sean Thurill is a professor of political science at the University of Texas at Austin. He's also the author of The Gingrich Senators.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian.
And I'm here at the Midwest Political Science Association conference, and I'm sitting here with David Redlisk, who's an expert in voting and elections and campaigning. And we're going to talk about his work in the context of the current political landscape. So
welcome, David Redlisk.
Thanks for having me.
I thought maybe we would start with some of your previous books and work up to your most recent one.
Sure.
How voters decide. One of your key questions was whether or not voters vote what you call correctly, meaning do they vote according to their values and what they would want politically. So how did you even test this, and what did you find?
The idea of voting correctly is basically asking whether voters in the range of candidates available to them in any given election manage to find the one who best represents their own interests as they express them. This is a little bit different, in fact, in some ways it's a lot different from the normative idea that people should be able to be rational in their decision making. And rational voting means essentially learning a great deal about all of the options and then balancing all those things you learn in order to make a decision. So the traditional view requires you to do really complex trade-offs sometimes between positions on one thing and positions on another. It's a little bit like the old guns versus butter, right? If you like your candidate on guns and you don't like your candidate on butter, how do you trade off on that? Our view is that that kind of complex decision-making in voting is not just unlikely to happen, but it's actually unnecessary to happen. Our view is that voters are pretty good at processing the information they come across in a campaign and reasonably good at discerning which candidates meet their interests.
So it really would contradict what's the matter with Kansas.
The reason that it might be seen to contradict it is that we don't stand somewhere on some platform saying this is the right way to vote and this is the wrong way to vote. Instead, we essentially are guided by voters' own preferences for their own interests. So we're not pretending as political scientists that we can tell voters this is what you should care about and this is what you shouldn't. The way I read What's the Matter with Kansas is it's an argument that voters should care about economics and shouldn't care about other things, and so they're being misled by those other things. That's not our view. So a correct vote, in our view, is one that a voter casts for a candidate who represents the interests that that voter expresses at that point.
Right.
Yeah, and the things they care about at that point.
So one of the things that you had written in one of your earlier books, it might have even been this one, was you were talking about the political science model so far that tried to predict voting. And you said, you know, there's kind of one problem with that. Campaigns and elections are dynamic. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these old models that did a pretty good job of predicting how people would vote, they don't account for the dynamism that goes on. I would say maybe this primary election could be your case in point. Would you say that's the case?
Perhaps. This primary election is an unusual one, I suppose, in some respects. One of the political scientists are pretty good at predicting general election vote, and the reason is that general elections are about partisanship. They're about party. And party, even today in the United States, where so many people claim to be independent voters, the vast majority of those who actually vote consistently vote one way or the other. And we're pretty good at predicting that. But primaries are within party contests, and so we don't have that heuristic, that partisanship, as a way to predict the result. So they're messier, they're more complicated, and trying to identify what is going to happen is much more difficult. From the standpoint of the dynamic aspects of a primary in the United States, presidential primaries, we're doing these things in a sequential form, so that Iowa came first back on February 1st, and we've had states go since then, and now we're coming soon to New York and Pennsylvania and eventually California. But that means that each election is conditioned, at least in part, on what happened before and the information that voters can glean from what happened before. And it's not as simple as just saying, I'm voting for this candidate because XYZ, because you also have information about what other voters did earlier and the way the campaign unfolded earlier. And I think it makes it a more complex process for voters.
So really, in fact, and you wrote a little bit about this, Iowa matters even to California?
Yeah, Iowa matters because it's first in this sequential process. This small state of 3 million people, 1% of the U.S. population, starts the whole ball rolling. And so Iowa matters a couple ways. One thing it routinely does is helps winnow the field. It cuts down the number of candidates. We came into the Iowa caucuses with 11 remaining active Republican candidates, and three of them dropped out right after the Iowa caucus. And so New Hampshire voters, who came next, had fewer choices than Iowa voters. On the Democratic side, there were five at the beginning, three by the time of the caucuses, and two left after that. So in one sense, Iowa matters because it winnows, and so do later primaries. It cuts the field. But Iowa also matters because candidates spend such a long time there.
And are expected to.
They're expected to be on the ground. They're expected to spend time. They're expected to talk to voters in a way that doesn't happen in later states, partly because they're big, partly because there isn't enough time. So Iowa matters because candidates learn directly from voters in a way they don't. They talk to voters, they answer questions, they have interactions. And I should be broader, because this also happens in New Hampshire and a little bit in South Carolina, these first states. A great example, and it's actually a New Hampshire example this time around, is the issue of heroin abuse, specifically heroin. This wasn't on anybody's radar. It wasn't something candidates talked about. But in New Hampshire and to some degree in Iowa, they were hearing it from voters. They were hearing about their family members, their friends. There is an epidemic in this country, and people were starting to talk about it. And suddenly candidates started to talk about it, and it became a part of the campaign. So Iowa matters, New Hampshire matters, these early state matters because of the interactions. And finally, they matter simply because they send information to later voters. Our research in our book, Why Iowa, says that the actual vote in Iowa and the way the media shifts its attention after Iowa has an impact on the vote outcomes, not just in New Hampshire, but across the whole primary.
It seems that's one of the other factors in this particular primary, both the fragmentation alongside with the new media and the ability of candidates to directly reach voters, but also to directly reach media in a way, using their own norms in order to get more attention. How much of an impact do you think that's making?
Well, I think we're just trying to figure out the impacts, particularly this time, both the traditional media and the new media. One of the things that we've tried to do, my colleagues and I, in this cycle is replicate the work we did in the 2008 cycle in the Iowa caucuses, trying to understand how media shifts affect the election. And what we found in our initial analyses was that our models aren't working as well this year as they have in the past, in particular our model of media attention and media shift. And a big part of that's Donald Trump. Donald Trump's access to the media has been unprecedented. And it's not just that he tweets, and he tweets far more than anyone else, and people talk about him far more than anyone else. In the run-up to the Iowa caucus, the final week, 63% of the tweets that we gathered were about Donald Trump, and the other 37% were about the other 10 Republican candidates. But even in the traditional media, the New York Times, 45% of its stories in the last week ahead of the Iowa caucus talked about Donald Trump. And again, there were 10 other candidates. So Trump's access to the media is unprecedented, and it's having, I think, unprecedented effects on the campaign as a whole.
I suppose there is a much smaller example on the Democrat side in that Bernie Sanders was treated as a fringe candidate for a very long time and didn't get much media attention. Hillary Clinton was always presumed to be the candidate that was going to go on to the general election.
Clinton was certainly expected to be the nominee, and at this point I will say she's still going to be the nominee. But certainly in the early stages, Sanders was viewed more as an issues candidate and almost a protest candidate, you know, appealing to the far left of the Democratic Party. And I think that the fact that he was able to ride that as effectively as he had is partly this sequential nature of the primaries. Iowa is an interesting state because the Iowa Democratic Party is quite liberal by the standards of Democratic parties across the country, and the Iowa Republicans are quite conservative compared to other Republican parties. And so a candidate like Bernie Sanders might have a natural base in a place like Iowa. There are just a large number of liberal progressive Democrats. I think 40% of Democrats in one poll said they'd be happy to be called socialists. So you don't have that in most states. Had this started in another state, I think Sanders might have had a harder time getting going. But he had a natural base to work with, and the media early on is less important in these small states compared to just getting out there and being visible with voters. And there was some residual dislike of Hillary Clinton out of 2008. But while the Sanders supporters, many of them continue to talk about how the media is ignoring their candidate, the evidence is that that's no longer true. And in fact, in the last weeks ahead of the Iowa caucuses, our data show New York Times mentions for Sanders just as much as Clinton, and the Twitter conversation was relatively equal as well. So Sanders may have started well behind in that sense, but he got onto an equal footing and has been there since.
Yeah. You have been studying how emotions come into play for things like memory and information seeking and retention. If you were going to give us sort of an overall sense of how this dynamic works and why it matters in elections, what would you say?
Politics is about emotions. And it's an interesting thing that political scientists in particular for a very long time ignored emotions. Partly because we were enthralled by this rational choice idea that people should think through things, and somewhat informed, I guess, in some ways by going all the way back to the Enlightenment and the separation of emotion and reason. And as scientists, we wanted to focus on reason. But politics is about emotion. You can't think about it without thinking about emotion. We also know from research directly in emotion that as human beings, we feel before we think. It's a sort of counterintuitive. It's like, how can I feel before I even know about something? But there's very clear evidence that when we encounter stimuli, and it can be anything, including political stimuli, that we actually respond emotionally before we can respond cognitively, before we can think about it. So it means that emotions are tied up in everything in some sense. And in politics, what it means in my own work, I focus primarily on the idea that when we encounter information, how we evaluate it is conditioned by what we already think, but more importantly, what we already feel. In my work, it's about candidates. Other people have done it in other domains. And so if we already know a candidate, if we already have an evaluation, positive, negative, liking, disliking, encountering new information about that candidate means evaluating in the context of how we already feel. And we call this motivated reasoning. And the idea of the motivation here is motivated to maintain an existing evaluation. Now, there's plenty of evidence that if people can be motivated in for other reasons, for example, motivated towards accuracy in their decision-making, we can overcome some of that, or at least we can work through some of that. But most of the time, and particularly I think in politics and campaigns and elections, our motivation is to form an evaluation and to stick with that evaluation. If I'm a Bernie Sanders supporter and you try to tell me something bad about Bernie Sanders, even if it's factually true and I could evaluate it as factually true, I'm going to resist it. And unlike rational views, I'm not going to update my evaluation in the correct direction. I'm not going to become less positive because I learned something bad. In fact, my own research suggests that we can become more positive in the face of negative information.
Although you did also say that there's a sort of tipping point in which when there's a lot of contradicting information to what you're already emotional and cognitive view of your candidate is, there can be a point in which people start to defect. And maybe we're seeing a little bit of that on some of the Republican side.
We know public opinion changes. we know support changes. So clearly this process, this motivated reasoning process, can't be so all-encompassing that we never change our opinions. And so in one study we did, we found the motivated reasoning process underway, and we found people becoming more positive towards a candidate in the face of negative information. We also found that negative emotions increased, in particular a sense of anxiety, as this negative information about an otherwise liked candidate became more and more a part of the environment. And so what we hypothesize is that it's that, and this comes out of some work by George Marcus and others on emotions, is that that discrete emotion of anxiety works in some sense as a trigger to tell us that the world is not what we expected and that maybe we better pay some attention. And in our study, that motivated reasoning process of, in effect, challenging the information we get that doesn't comport with our expectations gets interfered with as anxiety and negative emotions increase. At some point, we may actually begin to update accurately. But the interesting thing is, if our theory is right, to put it in concrete terms, let's say that I evaluate Bernie Sanders at 75 points on a 100-point scale. That's very positive. I learned something bad, and I should become less positive. But in fact, our data show I might start evaluating at 80 or 85, may become more positive to defend my existing preferences. If that tipping point's reached, if there's enough information, I may start evaluating him lower again, but I will now have started from a higher point.
It's a little bit reminiscent of the brain scans that Drew Wesson did also, but I think he found that it was only the extreme partisans that really had the cognitive dissonance when some negative information came about a candidate that they felt very positively about.
Yeah, one of the interesting things, and a lot of this motivated reasoning stuff kind of harkens back to early theories on cognitive dissonance, the idea that we need to maintain consistent cognitions about an object candidate, for example. But since that work in the 50s, there's also been a lot of evidence we can put up with a lot of inconsistency, that human beings have not that much trouble holding inconsistent views. And a lot depends on what views are activated at what point, how they're activated, why they're activated. But there's certainly the case that there are different knowledge bases among people who are more or less engaged. So political sophisticates or strong partisans who might be more engaged than those who are less politically knowledgeable or less partisan. And so clearly, the more strongly you hold an evaluation, the more cognitions you have about the candidate or the issue, the harder it's going to be to overcome those. I think that's absolutely true, because in the end, we can maintain dissonance without too much trouble.
What about this idea of affective intelligence that you've also been looking at? What do we draw from affective intelligence that works in politics?
So the theory of affective intelligence comes from George Marcus and his colleagues, and they basically argued that where we spend a lot of time talking about positive and negative, good and bad, that emotions are more complex, and certainly that's true. What they suggest is that we need to look at discrete emotions. We need to look specifically at anger and anxiety and enthusiasm. Those are the ones they've looked at specifically. With a couple of other colleagues of mine, Kyle Mattis and Ira Roseman, we're looking at a discrete emotion of contempt as well. And the fact is that there are times when simply thinking good, bad, positive, negative is good enough for our analysis purposes. And for a lot of motivated reasoning, works that way. Positive evaluations, negative evaluations. But what Marcus and company show is that the negative emotions are not all the same. And so anxiety seems to trigger learning and attention, where anger can be quite different. It's a negative emotion, and sometimes it doesn't differentiate, but anger does not necessarily trigger learning. It triggers a sense of frustration and maybe even wanting to get back at someone, wanting to attack, but that's different from a generalized sense of anxiety or worry. And the positive emotions, they look at enthusiasm in particular, seem much more fuzzy, like one group. And they tend to just keep us on a path we're already on until we're interrupted by a negative emotion. The key to their work, this affective intelligence work, is that these discrete emotions matter. So we're taking that partly in that motivated reasoning work where anxiety seemed to be a trigger to updating. We think the emotion of contempt may be very important because candidates, particularly let's use Donald Trump as
very
an example,
is
very contemptuous to not just his opponents, to lots of groups in society. And political scientists have not studied this emotion, have not looked at it. There's some debate about whether it's differentiable or not. But it clearly seems to be playing a role this time.
Just a reminder that you're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. And we're speaking with Professor David Redlosk about how voters decide.
I think that if we were to draw a line graph, you'd see probably a gradual increase in contempt, particularly with the right-wing sort of radio hosts. A lot of it coming from there.
Yeah. It's
hard to distinguish it sometimes from hate. We have to talk about your latest book, too, because it's a fascinating idea that there's something positive about negative campaigning. I mean, we all, to our core, sort of dislike the idea of the negative campaigning or the attack ads. But you're suggesting that we sometimes get better information from negative ads. You must have looked at a lot of negative campaigns, because the ones that stand out in my mind were really just exaggerations and very misleading. Say, Swift Boat, we talked about that yesterday. What's going on here?
I guess the first thing to keep in mind is that Kyle Mattis and I are looking at this as an informational issue and what is in the information environment. At the core, our basic argument is that an informational environment for voters that does not include negativity is incomplete. No candidate, presumably, is ever going to say anything bad about herself, right? She's going to talk about the good things. And it turns out positive advertising may be less accurate than negative advertising. Nobody keeps an eye on it. Nobody fact checks it. There's a lot of what the advertising people call puffery in it, you know, about how great I am and how wonderful what I've done is and so on. And in many ways, it's not particularly informative. Negative advertising is. Now, it doesn't mean some of it doesn't go beyond. It doesn't mean some of it isn't misleading. Truth does matter, and we find that voters care about the truth of the ads, but we also find voters are relatively discerning about this. The idea of negativity here is that I think voters need to know if a candidate has failed to accomplish something or promised something that didn't happen or just voted the quote wrong way on something. Well, that candidate's not going to tell you. What they're going to do is change the topic. They're going to change the subject entirely. And we find that voters in our studies are unable to make the inferences necessary without negativity. So if candidate A simply chooses not to talk about something, the inference ought to be made that there's a problem there. But what we find is unless candidate B can point that out, voters are not going to make that inference. So the broad picture here is that negativity as informative. There's data, John Geer in particular has done a lot of this. There are very good data that show that negative advertising is more accurate than positive advertising.
As a whole.
As a whole. Because it's usually cited. That is, when you see a negative ad, there are usually little footnotes and citations and headlines from newspapers, not necessarily made up. They are real and they are pointing to sources. Now, does it mean it's straight down the narrow path? Of course not. And we do find that voters care about the kinds of negativity. So they're pretty much okay, in our studies at least, with attacks on issues, with attacks on competence. They're not okay with attacks on things they consider irrelevant. And the two extremes we used were a candidate's family and religion. And we used them because there are recent examples. And while we wrote the book before this, just this last 2 weeks, right? Donald Trump takes off after Ted Cruz's wife, his family. And for maybe the first time, he suffers enough of a backlash that he has to actually apologize, or at least say, I wish I hadn't done it. Voters do recognize boundaries on negativity, and so I think that's an important point.
So essentially what you're arguing for is a richer informational environment.
Absolutely a richer informational environment, and we do a number of studies in this, but one of the things that's most fun for me is experimental economics-oriented study, which is basically where you bring people into a lab, and in groups, they play two candidates or a voter, and the candidates can reveal information, and the voter has to pick. And the voter and the candidates make real money depending on the decisions. They walk out of the lab with money, depending on the quality of their decisions. And what was very interesting about this is that voters made lower quality decisions. They made less money in environments where there wasn't negative information.
So two observations with the current primary dealing with the negativity. On the Democratic side of this primary, the candidates weren't particularly negative at first, and they both, well, the two front runners, they both used that almost as a campaign positive. You know, we're not going negative, but both have since gone negative. Mm-hmm. But whereas on the Republican side, it seems to have been negative from the beginning. Now, a couple of questions on that. Of course, analyze why that is. But the second part has to do something that you and I both heard in a panel discussion earlier this week, which is that negative campaigning affects the parties apparently differently. What's going on here?
First of all, on the Democrats, it's not really a good idea to say, I'm never going to go negative, which is what Bernie Sanders did at the beginning. He said, I will run only a positive campaign. I've never run a negative campaign in my life. Well, it's been a long time since he's had a real challenge, and I'll only stay positive. And that's just a really bad thing to say. And it's a bad thing to say because you won't, if it's at all competitive. A really key thing about negativity is the more competitive the campaign, the more negative it generally is. Why? Because these are pretty significant stakes. It's, you know, if you don't win, you lose. And so you get into a situation where, yes, you have to present the positive about yourself. You absolutely do. You have to introduce yourself to voters. You have to give them a reason to vote for you. But if you're the challenger, in the sense that Bernie Sanders is certainly the challenger against the establishment, whatever you want to call it, you know, the candidate who was expected to walk away at the nomination, you have to do a second thing. Besides introduce yourself, you have to convince people to not do what they are otherwise inclined to do. And that often takes negativity. You've got to point out the flaws in your opponent. We didn't see that early on because it was not a particularly competitive campaign early on.
And as I understand it, he said initially he was running for the issues and didn't really have an expectation of becoming a full-fledged opponent.
Yeah. Sanders definitely started this as an issue-oriented candidate rather than what we would call an office-seeking candidate. I suspect in his heart of hearts he might be as surprised as anyone that it turned out so close. And so when you're an issue-oriented candidate and you don't have an expectation of winning, your strategies can be very different. But I think you could point to when it became possible he could win, that you would also begin to notice the shift in the strategy and in the way he started talking. So even before the Iowa caucuses, he began to talk more about Clinton, but in oblique ways, not necessarily using her name. And then as it's gone on, he's gotten more and more direct. For Clinton as a front runner, there's a lot of evidence that front runners try to avoid going negative, mostly because why give your opponent any attention whatsoever if you're a clear front runner? And I think we saw that early on as well. For Clinton, Sanders was presumably just going to be an annoyance more than anything else, and why feed into that? Obviously, again, it's changed. It's become highly competitive, and as a consequence, the strategy's changed and the negativity increased. But I think these I won't go negative pledges are just a bad idea generally. The Republicans, it's interesting because there's a perception it's been negative. What's really interesting to me is that in the run-up, again, I keep talking about Iowa. I spent 6 months in Iowa ahead of the caucus. I was there from early August to caucus day, went to more than 100 candidate events. Every single candidate saw multiple times, talked to lots of people. But one of the things that struck me about Iowa in the run-up was actually how positive it was within the Republican candidates. They all attacked Obama. They all attacked the Democrats. That's perfectly reasonable because they're trying to show their, you know, that they are the best candidate to take on the Democrats. But there was not a lot of head-to-head attacks between the candidates. And part of it was there were just so many of them. There were 17, it might even be higher at one point. And if you start attacking, who do you attack, who do you not attack, when you don't know who really is the front runner? And early on, it wasn't clear. Secondly, we tend to think that candidates themselves do less of the attacking and outside money does more of it, the super PACs this time around in particular. But again, in the run-up to the caucuses, watching television in Iowa, it was amazing how many of these outside money, these super PAC ads, were positive. They were introducing the candidate. I just remember in particular Bobby Jindal ads, which were just all about who he was and his view on the world and what he would do, and rather than attacking. Now, as the field narrowed and it became easier both to identify a target, but also became clearer who would be front runners and who wouldn't, you began seeing the change. Now, that's putting aside Donald Trump, because Donald Trump's entire rhetoric tends to be, let's make America great again, everyone else is less than me, everyone else can be belittled, everyone else is, you know, Lion Ted and Little Marco and all of this kind of sort of contemptuous, dismissive rhetoric, which historically we haven't seen in this volume, in this way. And so I don't yet know where Trump really fits in all of this in that sense. But the Republican race, again, wasn't as negative as you would have thought up front. It's become more so. Ultimately, the question of negativity and its impact on voters is a tough question. And it's a tough question, you know, campaigns and consultants think, quote, negativity works, unquote. And that's why they do it. And maybe it does. But the problem is it's really difficult to disentangle it from anything else going on in the campaign. Campaigns are sui generis, individualistic. There is no campaign is like a previous campaign or another campaign. And so it becomes really hard to say it always does this, it always does that. It doesn't. It depends on the context. But there is some data. I don't know how good it is, but there have been some hints over the years that Republicans in particular are less bothered by negativity. There's less chance of a backlash if you go negative compared to Democrats. I don't know how much I believe that. I actually don't think there's as much backlash in general about negativity that people seem to think there is. But there does seem to be some partisan difference, but you know, some researchers are only just beginning to tease some of that out.
David Redlosk, professor at Rutgers University, thank you so much for being with us on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you very much for having me.
David Redlosk is a professor of political science at Rutgers University, co-author of How Voters Decide, and author of the new book, The Positive Case for Negative Campaigning.
When we come back, Power in America, what it is, who has it, and how it works. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. It's no secret that top executives and corporate owners use their influence to maintain power through lobbying, think tanks, access to the media, campaign contributions. The people at the tops of the corporations and related institutions work to shape opinions and influence the laws and public policies. But can this dynamic be demystified and analyzed and properly understood? Our next guest does that. In a series of books, Professor William Domhoff has analyzed power in America, what it is, who has it, and how it works. Some of his books include the classic Who Rules America?, Who Really Rules?, Changing the Powers That Be, Diversity in the Power Elite, and Blacks in the White Elite. Welcome, Dr. Domhoff.
Thank you.
It's great to have you with us finally.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
So let's start with power itself. You talk about power as a dimension within the human experience that shapes our interactions and our institutions. Talk a bit about that.
I put it in the context that there's many other things. There's love and curiosity and joy and everyday life. But shaping everything is this one dimension of power that is in every part of life, whether it's in a family or an organization or in the larger society. And I think truly that the closest thing is to what we call a pecking order. There's a structure on who's on top, who's next level, and people fight to hold on to their level, even if it's a very middle kind of level. And the middle levels don't necessarily join together with the lower levels to try to change the higher level. So we've got this very much of a hierarchical society, and I think that's more or less true of most societies beyond a very basic level.
Now, you actually put it on a spectrum of egalitarian and domination. And so you say there's egalitarianism on one side and there's domination on the other.
And I think that if we look in the context of the United States, the people that want more equality on all kinds of things, whether it's the gender hierarchy or the color hierarchy or the sexual orientation hierarchy, they've ended up in this party called the Democratic Party, which is a very heterogeneous party, as you know. It's a gigantic collection of outgroups in America, whether on income or color or gender or a whole lot of things. And we have another party that's very hierarchical. People have their proper place. They should stay in it. That party has become even more concentrated on that issue. They've resented the civil rights movement, and that moved a lot of whites, particularly in the South, into the Republican Party. They resented the feminist movement, and that moved a lot of people in there. They resented any people that didn't want to have a hierarchical religion or any religion at all. So that party's very hierarchical.
Now, the Democrats, some would hold, are still kind of buying into the hierarchy, and this is why there have been a lot of breakaways and trying to build third parties and sort of a thing. Mm-hmm. But you think that actually divides power too much?
Right. I think third parties are a dramatic mistake in the United States. They are the number one reason why the country is not more egalitarian. And the number one example of that is so obvious, and that's Ralph Nader in 2000. And many of us really begged him and others not to do that. And all that a handful of leftists and environmentalists had left on the day of the election was their vote. They had that power. They could do what they wanted. And in New Hampshire, enough of them, and in Florida, gave their vote to George Bush. And they always speak about how terrible and boring and so on Gore was, and not very strong. And there were a million reasons why Gore failed in 2000. When it's that close, there's a million reasons. But there was one reason they controlled, and that was their vote. And that mentality, which involves some of the greatest minds in America, starting with Noam Chomsky and Barbara Ehrenreich and a lot of our most honored names, right there they were, by the hundreds, urging people to vote for Ralph Nader. And, of course, that was the start of our most recent disasters. That is what gave us George Bush, and they hate that, and they don't like me for saying it.
Yeah.
But that's the start of it. Anybody that's a feminist, an environmentalist, a gay rights activist, for them, putting Republicans in charge for 8 years has not made it pleasant or easier, not in the short run in their everyday lives, nor in the long run.
There's actually some conflicting research on this in the political science community as well.
There may be, but you're asking my opinion.
I am.
Telling you.
I know, but
that's a disaster.
I just didn't want to lose too much time.
Okay, well, you'll lose your listeners, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, and I do know there's some conflicting research on how much of a role Ralph Nader actually played in the loss of the election, because there's some research that those voters that voted for him actually weren't going to come out to vote anyway. But there's so many more things that I think that you bring to the table that I'd like to actually discuss, particularly with the structures of power in America and how these things kind of continue to reinforce themselves. You've talked about this in terms of class and in terms of money, but also in terms of the institutions they've created, the foundations, the think tanks. I want you to give us a kind of a thumbnail sketch.
Well, the basic point is that gradually over the 19th century developed this form of private property called a corporation, which can perpetuate itself, which has the same right as individuals. And from there, the campaign finance donations, the ability to hire lobbyists, the ability to hire front groups to go out and say they are Zionists and there's no global warming, all of those kinds of things in a gradual kind of accumulation lead to a situation where the very important point is that they can capture control of government. And it's not just in the air or ideological. It is by having your people actually in the positions of importance in government, whether it's on coal mine safety or air quality or any of the issues of how the economy is formulated. We've seen this disaster over the housing crisis. The whole way it's attempted to be solved is, number one, to save the major investment banks. That's not because of some general ideology or belief system. It's because the people in corporations, through campaign finance and lobbying and hiring experts, have been able to structure the laws. So it's very specific. It's very direct. It's not behind the scenes. You can read about it every day in the New York Times. And the key things that they've been able to defeat were first the unions, and the defeat of unions went on gradually over the 60s and the 70s. And once they are defeated, because they were the number one bulwark against the corporations, cautious though they are, often corrupt, all of that, they were still the main power base for anybody that was not at the higher levels of the corporate community. And once that base was routed, then you're all set, because you're able to draw middle American whites into the Republican Party, voting their skin color, their religion, not their economics. And that social conservative coalition, in conjunction with the corporate coalition, leads to a situation where it's an easy rule. Corporations would be ruling as exactly they were throughout the early part of the 21st century, except for one thing, and that was the failure of the war in Iraq. There was nobody in America that could stop the George Bush coalition. The only thing that stopped it was that coalition themselves, because the war was a disaster, and in the 2006 election, the centrist turned against them. And if the Democrats happen to win, it will be because, once again, the centrists have felt that the economy has been run into the ground, and they will become fearful. And centrist women will become fearful that perhaps they will lose any right to choose. And those will be what decides the election, not whether the Democrats are clever or hide the fact that they want to tax the middle class. It's whether the centrist voters in America continue to decide to vote their various kinds of social issues versus their economic issues. The corporations have to have a set of loyal voters, and they've worked very hard at that, and they've found those voters through all of these what are called the social issues, and it really is very straightforward. Also, of course, you do work to keep as many people that might vote Democrat from voting, and there's a whole literature on voter suppression, about which there is little doubt by political scientists, that Republicans do actively work to suppress turnout by low-income people who are slightly more likely to vote Democratic, although they certainly have their own prejudice around gender and color and so on. So that, in a nutshell, is what goes on in the United States. And the question before the America now is, are you going to vote your class and your economic interests, or are you going to vote your skin color and your ethnic prejudices and your religious preferences? That's what they face. And for the corporations, it will mean some accommodation, some small accommodations. If a centrist Democrat wins, they will have to pay a little more taxes, and so on and so forth. But it won't be a disaster to the corporate rich if they have to become part of a new coalition.
So, in fact, some political scientists have said that the president can't make any kind of radical change, that if he did try to make radical change, that there would, in fact, be kind of a corporate strike, which would be just this huge loss in confidence on Wall Street, and the economy would just go into the dump again.
I don't think any of that's true. If, for instance, a fairly liberal president was in charge, And you've got to have 60 votes in the Senate and a majority, of course, in the House. But in that situation, if corporations decided not to invest, which, of course, they would never stop investing, it's a crazy thought that came from crazy economists that they would stop investing somehow to get rid of the government. If they stop investing, other corporations will get their market share. Furthermore, the government would start making investments, as they did during the New Deal, as they did during World War II, and suddenly the corporations who were allegedly on a capital strike would find themselves falling behind. So that's not going to happen. That's just, I think, in the fantasy realm of the kind of people that we didn't want to talk about earlier. So that's just not the real problem. The president has a really dramatic impact. If there's a centrist Democrat in the White House, then there's a whole lot of things that don't happen. Just the small changes in taxes, and I'm no fan of Bill Clinton's, I can assure you, but just the small changes that he made in the taxes, which had no impact on the lifestyle of the very rich, they made a huge difference in the American economy. So, yes, you're not allowed to talk about taxes. The Republicans yell and scream about taxes, and George Lakoff wants to properly frame all that. But the truth of the matter is that if there were a progressive taxation in this country, taxes on the well-to-do, just to the level there was when Ronald Reagan came in, of course you could pay for all of these programs. Of course you wouldn't have these huge debts. The debt disappeared under Clinton. The Republicans were so shocked, they were afraid. What is this? We don't have a debt. So you can make a huge difference who you put in charge of the Federal Reserve, who's in charge of the Securities and Exchange Commission. Now, you're never going to get suddenly some paradise. You get a benign society like a Canada. God forbid, we might even be decent as Germany or Denmark or so on. Very easily done in terms of, instead of the top 10% having 70-some percent of the wealth, the top 10% only has 50% of the wealth. And that, those other countries, makes a huge difference. So I think it matters who's the president. I think there's all sorts of things you can do to the economy. There are ways to tame the giant corporations. All of that is right there. It's easily enough done. But analysis by the insurgents, by the opponents, has not been good. The liberals and the leftists have never been able to develop a sensible coalition in America. And the net result is, and I like George Lakoff, know him, think he's great, but the net result, because of the fact that liberals and leftists can't make a strategic alliance, is that we have to worry about framing instead of about fighting it straight out on the bigger kind of issue. Yeah, we've got to unionize. Yeah, we've got to do this and that and the other thing that are, as I say, all doable.
William Domhoff, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.